Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry. The former attorney is the author of 15 espionage-like thrillers, including 11 in his Cotton Malone series of novels, the latest of which is being published today, The 14th Colony. Barry uses historical anomalies and obscure facts to create his novels such as The Romanov Prophecy, The Templar Legacy, The Charlemagne Pursuit, and others. For The 14th Colony, he uses a little-known quirk of the 20th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, as well as secret plans drawn up by the War Department to invade Canada if England had capitulated to the Nazis back in World War II. Barry is also involved in historic preservation, and his book event launched tonight will involve a fundraiser for the restoration of the Alice Mary Robertson home in Muskogee. It's part of his History Matters project that combines personal appearances with fundraisers to help preserve historic structures. Robertson herself was the second woman in the United States elected to Congress back in 1920, the only woman elected from Oklahoma until Mary Fallon was elected in 2006. There'll be a special book signing, reading, and reception at Gilcrease. You can visit myticketoffice.com for information about the event. I spoke with Steve Barry by phone yesterday. Steve Barry, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Your latest novel is just coming out, The 14th Colony, and you've chosen to start your book tour with sort of an event that you do on your book tours. It's part of your History Matters project. Why start in Tulsa? And tell us a little bit about History Matters, if you would.
Well, Tulsa had gotten in touch with us a few years ago about doing a project here. We weren't able to get out this way, and we got back in touch with them last year and said we'd love to come, and they said they'd love to have us. So that's how we got here. History Matters is a foundation my wife Elizabeth and I started 7 years ago, and we go around and we help communities raise money for historic preservation, and we do it through many different ways. We'll do dinners, meet and greets. The main way we do it is we teach a writer's workshop where people buy their way in with a contribution. All of the money that we raise from the workshops and the meet and greets and the dinners go to the project that we're there to support. We don't charge expenses or anything like that to come. We actually pay our own way to come to the events. So we'll be doing a meet and greet in Tulsa, and we'll be talking about the book, taking questions, interacting, signing books. All of the money from the ticket sales will go to the restoration of the Alice Robertson House, and we're looking forward to coming back to Tulsa.
Alice Robertson was Oklahoma's first congresswoman, and she was one of the very first women to be elected to Congress. Jeanette Rankin was the first. Jeanette Rankin, who cast dissenting votes in the United States entering World War I, and later she finally got back to Congress to do a dissenting vote on World War II. But Alice Robertson was the second woman elected to Congress. She only served one term, and you will be raising funds for the preservation of her home, which I guess is in not the greatest shape. Do you know much about Alice Robertson?
I have read a little bit about her. You know, I learned that she was an educator, and she helped, you know, start the college here, and that she was she had a wide variety of things. I mean, she operated a dairy farm, a cafeteria, a photography studio. She was a postmaster. She had a quite a varied life.
And it was interesting. She was an anti-feminist, even though you would think from her position she would be a feminist at the time. She was against the League of Women Voters, and she was kind of an interesting character.
Yeah, when I heard about what we were doing, I did some reading on it. I'm hoping to get a chance to take a quick look at the house. I'd like to see it.
Now, what is your passion for helping preserve historic places like this?
Well, they're vanishing. I mean, we Elizabeth and I travel all over the country promoting the books, and we came to see that historic preservation was in deep trouble. I served as a county commissioner for 14 years, and we didn't have a dime of money for historic preservation. So one of the missions of History Matters is to impress upon local communities that historic preservation is all about local efforts. There's no one going to come in and save your stuff for you. You've got to do it yourself, and you've got to come up with innovative ways to do it. And History Matters offers some of those innovative ways.
Now, what are some of the innovative ways a community can save a structure? Because a lot of times, you know, say a historic house will be saved, but there's really not enough I mean, there'll be some interest, but there's not enough interest to make it an ongoing concern to pay its own way, so to speak.
Yeah, you've got to generate that interest. It's one of the things we talk with them about. An example would be what we did in Albany a few years ago. They brought us up there. The University Club up there is a very historic building from the 19th century, and its roof was falling apart. They brought us up there, and they were going to kick off a Raise the Roof campaign to raise the money necessary to fix the roof. And we came in to help kick that off. And we had a big gala, and we had a big thing up there. And they worked sponsors, and they worked the community. And they started off, you know, we raised $15,000, $20,000 that night. But they ultimately raised $100,000+ they needed to put the new roof on there. So what we try to show local communities is they have to get really, really active in this, and they have to convince the local residents that this is an important thing that's important to the local community itself. And it's all about just working that and putting that together. We help with that somewhat.
Now, what can you learn from the historic home of a person like, say, an Alice Mary Robertson?
You know, to be honest with you, you don't learn a lot from the house itself per se, but it is her house, and she is a part of our past. And the house acts as a connection between us and her. It's a point of remembrance. It's when people drive by there and they see it. That's Alice Robertson's house. Who's that? Let me tell you who she is. You know, people come to see the house because they want to know about her. So you don't learn, in this particular instance, you don't. Now, you might learn things like at Monticello. You'll learn things about Jefferson and other houses built by the person themselves. You might learn some things about them. Here, it's more just a conduit.
And it's a sort of a visceral way to keep that name within public focus, maybe?
Yeah, you have to have tangible things. We've learned that from experience out there. You know, tangible items are important, and that's why historic preservation is important. You know, you can tell somebody about something, but that's not even close to showing them.
What's been some of the most significant projects you've had a hand in helping restore? What's been most near and dear to your heart?
I have to be honest with you, I like them all because all of them are important in their own way. We did the Lincoln Log Cabin up in Illinois. We've done the Smithsonian. We raised money to help with the Smithsonian libraries. We've done the rare book room at the University of Virginia to help with the restoration of some of their rare volumes. We did these really interesting things, the P.T. Barnum posters up in Connecticut at the P.T. Barnum Museum there. They needed some money to preserve these 19th century posters that were deteriorating. We've done such a variety of different things. We did a big event at the Mark Twain House where we raised quite a bit of money. Each one is important. I learned a vital lesson early on. We did an event when we first started off out in California for a museum. And we raised $5,000, which I didn't think was a lot of money. And I was a little disappointed, and I told the organizers that, and they cut me off immediately. They said, no, you don't understand what just happened here. Our museum is a 19th century Victorian structure. It has a huge hole in the roof upstairs that we cannot fix. This $5,000 will now patch that hole, which will save the building. So I learned very quickly that a small amount of money can go a long way.
A lot of these little small home-focused museums or even small museums, a small amount of money is it's a big deal.
It's a very big deal. And that money particularly, that museum building is still there today and in good shape. And I heard from them about a year or two ago, and they were still very grateful that we were able to patch that hole in the roof that was destroying the building.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like that's a good reason to keep writing books.
Yep, that's why we keep doing it. That's why we keep doing History Matters. We do around 6 History Matters projects a year is what we do now, and we pick them and plan them about a year in advance, so we're planning next year's already.
Now, history plays such a large role in your writing. Have you learned anything over the course of doing these History Matters projects that have sort of ended up as at least maybe a sideline in a book?
Oh, yeah. We were out in Iowa, and Des Moines, Iowa, and we did an event out there, a History Matters event, and they took us to another place called Salisbury House, which we were going to do a History Matters event there, but we never got to be able to schedule it to do it. But Salisbury House so impressed me, I put it in the Lincoln Myth, so it's actually in the novel. So, yes, some of these places do sneak in.
And what was fascinating about the Salisbury House?
It's a neat place. It's this. It's almost like a English manor house in the middle of an Iowa neighborhood. And it was built by a family back at the turn of the 20th century who were so taken by English manor houses. And so they built this thing, and it's very unusual where it sits there. You're kind of just like, wow, where did that come from in this kind of suburbia neighborhood? But the Salisbury House had been there first. And they've tried to do it served as a government house for a long time, and they did some destruction to it, and they've since put a lot of it back together. And we wanted to do a History Matters event there, but we were never able to schedule it with their schedule to put it together. But it was such a neat place that when I wrote the Lincoln Myth, I put a key scene there.
And so this is like a 17th, 18th century big...
early 20th century.
Well, I mean, but it's modeled on like
yes,
the 17th, 18th century
manor house
where a lord would have lived.
It has a big Tudor room and a Tudor fireplace. And it's actually a neat building, and they use it now as a... like a meeting center is that what they do with it now.
Your latest book, which is the reason you're coming to Tulsa, is a fundraising appearance for the restoration of the Alice Mary Robertson House, but it's also to celebrate the publication of your latest novel, The 14th Colony.
Yep.
Now, for those who are not familiar with your work, your protagonist is Cotton Malone. Tell us a little bit about Cotton Malone.
He's a retired Justice Department agent. He lives in Copenhagen. He runs an old bookshop, and he kind of stays in trouble all the time. He wants to leave his former life behind, but he keeps finding him, and it just won't let him go. And so he gets drawn in. This is his 11th adventure. That shouldn't put off anyone, because I write the books where you don't have to read them in any order whatsoever. You can actually read the series backwards, and it would be fine. So you can jump right in here with the 14th Colony and get to know Cotton Malone. Kind of interesting character. When I created him, I didn't know he was going to stay around a while, so I kind of modeled him after me. So there's a lot of my personality in Cotton. And so he's kind of grown over 11 books, and this time he gets caught up in an exciting 48-hour adventure that leads up to the inauguration of a new president.
He works for a covert division within the Justice Department called Magellan Billet.
He used to.
He used to.
He's retired now, but they draw him back in for, like, contract work.
And in this case, the whole future of Magellan Billet is somewhat in doubt because the new president is not a fan.
No, I knew at some point that my president, Danny Daniels, was going to come out of office, and I wanted to do a story that dealt with the 20th Amendment to the Constitution. There's a flaw in the 20th Amendment. There's also a flaw in the 1947 Presidential Succession Act. And I wanted to deal with this in a thriller and expose the readers to this flaw. It's a flaw that Congress has been aware of for like 70 years, but for some odd reason refuses to fix it. So I fashioned this Cotton Malone thriller around it. So the reader's going to get a good understanding as to what happens in certain situations. I'll give you one example of a flaw that'll show you something that I'm talking about. We all know that if the president dies and the vice president dies, the Secretary of State takes over.
Right.
Okay, here's the problem. The Constitution specifically forbids a member of Congress from serving as president. So in order to take the oath, the Speaker of the House has to resign his or her seat.
Ah.
The moment they resign the seat, they're not Speaker and not eligible to succeed. And that's exactly how the law is drawn. It does not plug that loophole in any way.
Interesting. And this is the 20th Amendment, which, if I remember right, isn't the 20th Amendment the one that deals with the direct election of senators?
No, that's the 17th.
Oh, that's the 17th.
The 20th Amendment deals with, they had a situation where, when does the president's term end? When exactly does it end? Well, we now know that a president's term ends exactly at January the 20th, at noon on January
the 20th. So this is the one that moves the presidential inauguration date from March to January 20th. Okay,
And changes all of this to January 20th. So the president's term, we know the amendment is drawn that says the president's term ends. It doesn't talk about the beginning of the new president. It just says the president's term is over, so there's no way in the world that anybody can hold over and keep being president. It ends at noon on January 20th. The oath is taken. But here's an interesting flaw. What happens when the vice president-elect and the president-elect are both killed before taking the oath of office? Now you've got a serious mess.
Yeah, and the whole thing with the Speaker of the House, I mean, obviously that would be a court case if ever.
It would be massive, but the problem is the country would be in chaos because we wouldn't know who's in charge.
Right.
And you would have just a total mess, and for some reason Congress will not fix these loopholes that they are keenly aware of.
My guest today is Steve Barry. He's a spy thriller author, and he salivates at getting these little discrepancies in our history, and it's apparent in his most recent book, The 14th Colony. And The 14th Colony, this is sort of some interesting history in and of itself. What was the 14th Colony?
A fascinating thing. We had an obsession with having a 14th Colony, and it was supposed to be Canada. We wanted Canada bad. The first thing we did in the Revolutionary War, we invaded Canada. We got defeated. In 1815, when the War of 1812 was going on, the first thing we did, we invaded Canada. We got defeated. Canada is the only nation in the world that has defeated America twice on the battlefield. And what a lot of people don't know is in 1935, we fashioned an invasion plan of Canada, a plan that stayed classified until 1974. And if Hitler had taken England in 1939, 1940, we would have invaded Canada. And the plan was not only formulated, we took steps to implement it. And all of this is dealt with in the novel.
Now, why would we invade Canada if Hitler took England?
Because they were terrified that if he took England, he would then come over to Canada and use it as a base for which to invade America.
Mm.
And so they were going to prevent that immediately. And they were going to take and secure. We had our border secure. We did not have the northern border secure. And remember, the Canadian-American border is 5,800 miles long. It is the largest unprotected border in the world. So Hitler would have had a pretty good, easy run to come down into America.
Mm. And, of course, the other part of it was that Hitler had been secretly having correspondence with the Duke of Windsor, the deposed Edward VIII. And the idea would be if he took England, he would reinstall Edward VIII.
There was some discussion of that. He would be a puppet. And then, of course, Canada at that time was part of the British Commonwealth. It would have split immediately from that. But still, the fear was Hitler would come across and just start taking Iceland, Greenland, Canada. We're next.
Yeah. And so what did the battle plan in this late 30s look like?
Oh, it was massive. And I put a good chunk of it in the novel so you could see exactly what they were planning. They were planning a building of air bases. They were planning a land invasion. They even strategized how to take the invasion, what to take, what to control. They wanted to get control of the Canadian Railroad. The ports on the east and western shores had to be secured immediately. They had a very detailed plan in place, and they actually built some of the air bases and took steps to implement it. So it's a fascinating thing that I never knew about, and I said I wove that all into the story.
What was the reaction in Canada when this finally became public, which I assume has been some time?
About 1974 is when it all became declassified and out then. There's been a couple of books written on the subject. I think they were more amused than anything else, but they don't really realize how serious we were, because I read some things about this, and if we had taken Canada, by the way, we were not going to give it back. that once we took it, we were going to keep it.
Now, this also plays into a sort of a plot within the ancient Society of Cincinnati.
Yeah, the Society of Cincinnati is the oldest fraternal organization in America, and I had never heard of it until a few years ago when I came across it. I visited their headquarters in D.C. at a place called Anderson House, which is in the novel, and I decided to weave them into the story. They're a philanthropic organization that date back to the Revolutionary War. They were created by officers who fought in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, George Washington's immediate adjutants,
yes,
basically.
John Knox created it, but Washington himself served as its first president. The organization was feared in the beginning because a group of army officers convening every month with a lot of money at their disposal was scary to a lot of people. And it took Washington himself to calm people's fears and calm it down. The society eventually evolved, as I said, into a heraldic kind of philanthropic organization, but I decided to give it a few extra purposes.
And that's the novelist's option.
Yeah, it's my fun to put it in there. But it does make people know they exist and recognize them. And there's a writer's note in the back of all of my novels that tells you exactly what's true and what's not, so you can delineate between that. My novels stay about 90% accurate to history. It's only that 10% I trip up, but I tell you where that is.
Now, certainly there was a, at the prologue, there's a meeting between Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul. It was the first time a pope and a president ever spoke alone. I assume that was all your invention.
No, that's real.
Well, I know they actually spoke, but their secret plot to bring down the Soviet Union, that was probably
not my invention. No, not really.
Not really?
But we don't know what they talked about that day. We don't. There's no record of it anywhere, and none of them ever spoke about it, and no one was present but the two men. What we think happened and what historians believed happened is that they kind of confirmed between themselves a tacit agreement that they would work independently of one another and bring the Soviet Union down, because that's exactly what they did for the next 6 years, is they worked independent. Reagan bankrupted them, and John Paul worked on the moral conscience of Eastern Europe. And eventually the Soviet Union imploded from the pressure that they put on them. All of the words that they speak in my prologue are taken from their actual words somewhere else.
Mm.
I didn't make any of that language up. That is their words taken from somewhere else, and I just plugged them into that meeting.
My guest today is Steve Barry. His latest book is titled The 14th Colony, the New York Times bestselling espionage thriller writer. He'll be appearing in Tulsa this evening in a special benefit appearance to publicize the book, but more importantly, through his History Matters group, is to raise money for the restoration of the Alice Mary Robertson House, the home of Oklahoma's first congresswoman, trying to preserve and restore that home. That's an ongoing concern for my guest today, Steve Barry. Well, now, tell me how you go about reading history. I mean, obviously, your series have been, for the most part, you've been set in sort of the end of the Cold War and early, this sort of last 50 years. So how do you go about reading history to say, okay, this is a history I want to use?
Well, I try to find something from the past, something lost, something forgotten, something that you may not know a lot about but want to know more about. And I have to search for those things. And in this case, I came across this flaw in the 20th Amendment. I came across the meeting with John Paul and Ronald Reagan. I came across the Society of Cincinnati, the invasion of Canada. Then the fact that the Soviet Union produced 250 suitcase-sized nuclear weapons that no one has ever laid eyes on. No one's ever seen them. Congress recognized these in 1999 as a credible threat. And then there were weapons caches all over the world that the KGB hid. We know this because we found two of them, but we haven't found all of them. And so all of these elements kind of came together to form the 14th colony, to put it together. As I said, I try to keep my story 90% as close to reality as possible. So I don't like to make up those historical elements. Those need to be real.
And so you do a lot of historians' work. Do you do a lot of original research, like going back to original documents, or are you depending on writers?
Sometimes original. Most times, no, because I'm not writing a history book. I'm writing a novel to entertain you, so I deal with it in broad strokes. But if I need to get the voice, like, for example, what Reagan and John Paul said, yes, I had to go see some original things there and see their actual words. I use around 300 to 400 sources per novel. I don't read 300 to 400 books, but I read large chunks of them. And my research process takes about 18 months on the novel.
Of course, in this book, also, there's quite a bit about the Madison administration as well.
Yes, with the War of 1812 and the burning of the White House, and all of that is connected, all comes together. So, yes, we deal with, the War of 1812 was kind of an unnecessary war. Madison picked that fight, and that's the fight he wanted, and he got it, and he ended up kind of regretting having to get that fight. We like to say in American history that we won that war, but we really didn't. It was at most a tie.
Yeah, we basically wore down Great Britain's will to mess with us more.
Yeah, they didn't want the fight to start with, because they were fighting Napoleon at the time, and they were really, really angry with Madison for picking the fight. And that's one reason they burned Washington. Another reason is we went up and burned Montreal, we set fire up there. So we kind of picked that entire fight, and we got exactly what we asked for.
Well, you can learn more about that at a special reception. It's going to take place at Gilcrease Museum this evening, and it will help preserve the home of Alice Mary Robertson by raising needed funds to restore that home. And Steve Berry, we wish you a lot of success with History Matters and the 14th Colony. Thanks so much for joining us.
If the readers want to know more about me or History Matters or the event tonight, they can go to steveberry.org. Everything's there.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Internationally best-selling thriller novelist Steve Berry speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book, The 14th Colony, is released today, and he'll have a special book signing event and book event launched this evening, which will also be a fundraiser for the restoration of the Alice Mary Robertson home in Muskogee, part of his History Matters project. The event takes place beginning at 6:30 with a reception and then a reading and book signing at 7 at Gilcrease Museum. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Jeff Nix.
Since I became an official senior citizen, I've had more time to do a lot of things, including spending more time working out at the gym. And since I work out in the mornings, I see others of my generation working out too. And like me, many of the other guys are lifting weights and using weight machines. So I assume that their goal, like mine, is to someday become strong enough to open a jar of salsa, a ketchup bottle, a tear-open packet, or a childproof bottle of pain reliever without having to use pliers, a hammer, a knife, or our teeth. I can't help but believe that all products are sold in any kind of package or manufactured and distributed by sellers who basically have two departments. One department that comes up with a product idea and makes it, I'll call that product manufacturing, and a totally different department that packages the product, I'll call the Department of Defense. Manufacturing makes it. Packaging finds ways to keep the product from being opened by all but the strongest or those with access to tools like pliers, hammers, knives, or good strong teeth. Of course, some packaging concepts, specifically shrink wrap, have probably led to the diminishing popularity of certain products, like CDs. Can't open a CD without using a knife or your car keys? Forget about opening it. Forget about even buying it. On the other hand, though, the shrink wrap around CDs might well be worth considering by some members of the political right who want to seal off the U.S.-Mexican border. The border, if it were shrink wrapped, would be impenetrable, but you could still see who might be approaching. And what about childproof medicine bottles? Look, my kids are long out of the house and in their 40s, so nothing in my house has to be childproofed except, on occasion, my checkbook. Yes, I do have the occasional visit from my grandson, but product packagers might be stunned to learn that the first thing my grandson goes to play with is not my medicine bottles. And speaking of medicine bottles, specifically over-the-counter pain reliever bottles, what stupid idiot came up with the idea of jamming a ball of cotton down into a bottle? What is the cotton for? To keep the pills from rattling? I don't care if they rattle. I just want to take a pain pill. And has anybody ever been able to get that cotton ball out of the bottle without using a sharp object or tweezers, and then only on the fifth or sixth try? I think not. And finally, although it may seem at first unrelated to my dissertation on senioritis and package bottle jar opening, I understand that in many states, switchblade knives are now legal. And one strong argument in favor of such legalization, here and elsewhere, might be that my senior generation could use such knives to open our packages and containers. One could cut the seal on the bottle, hack off the shrink wrap, cut the wrapping ties, pry off the childproof cap, or fish out the blankety-blank cotton ball in the bottle. And a switchblade folds up and slides easily into the sweatpants many of us wear around the house. Wish I'd thought of putting a switchblade knife on my Christmas list. Well, I do have a birthday coming up, and clearly packages aren't going to get any easier to open anytime soon.
Jeff Nix is a former attorney and a contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.